Good afternoon. The audios were scheduled to begin Monday. Circumstances over the last 2 weeks, for a variety of reasons, no one in particular, now require that I begin next Monday, not this Monday, the 18th. So it'll be the 25th. So it's only for you here. And I decided that once I began, I wanted to be ahead on the video broadcasts. And that meant catching up after the feast. So I did three programs this week. I don't know that I've ever done three brand new programs this week, and I'm actually going to do another one on Monday and another one Tuesday. So I did one on Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday, all three on the black horse, and the two on the pale horse will be Monday and Tuesday. And again, for most of the church, all outside this room, they will have heard all of the black horse series and the first of the pale horse series, I guess, by the time part two of this sermon is given. Now, both parts are not about that subject, but they certainly are part of it. I wanted to be ahead so that when I begin this new endeavor, if you will, the daily audios, Monday to Friday anyway, that my plate was clear and the book is utterly and completely and absolutely done. I had this rule that if any new ideas arose for the book, I would add them right up until we hit the final moment of print. Then there was nothing else that could go into it. It was difficult in a way because so many things were happening on the world scene. I will come to that a little bit later today, unless I run out of time, and it'll open the sermon next week. But an awful lot has been happening. So I am more than eager to get into the daily audios. A lot of ideas are underway. We may have 20 to 30 different ideas. Of course, starting next Monday means we actually do some taping this week. And I want to do several before the week is out. But that's kind of a report on where we are. This, in some ways, I guess, depends on how you measure it against other sermons. If it's not the most awful sermon, then it is certainly one of the most awful sermons that I will ever have to cover. It's not entirely new, but it's summarized in a way so that it creates a clear and complete picture. I've learned some extra things about the subjects at hand, and I want to be sure they're all said in one sermon at the same way. And then, of course, for reasons you'll only understand next week, you'll see they actually introduced next week's sermon, which is related but very much different, more different than, I guess, related. But you simply have to have this as the foundation. Now, all of you here have read the book, and you have at least here watched part one of The Black Horse last night. And I explained to the staff when we watched it yesterday afternoon, presumably all of you have seen it, or maybe after service, as some of you will. This is probably, as strong as it was and as sobering as it was, shocking as the graphics were, and as electrified as I tried to deliver it and be when I did, it is the least of the next four broadcasts in terms of power. And now we are officially into a time, if the Red Horse series did not begin this, we are officially into a time when I am saying things that have never been said ever in 6,000 years on a tool that reaches every nation, territory, and dependency of the world. It's going to have an impact. It's going to have an effect. And I don't presume to know because it is not part of a grand pattern that I've ever seen. Mr. Armstrong never spoke in the kind of detail that I am or that the book brings. Now, the final edition of the book, I can maybe summarize for those of you who, of course, would not have read the final version. Don't be discouraged. This takes a little further direction from what I said at the feast. I made about 10,000 small changes to the book. And it's a much stronger book. And I added about 10,000 words. So it's about 5% longer, roughly, and almost exactly 10,000 words and about 10,000 changes. As a matter of fact, later in the sermon, you'll actually hear a couple of things I'm going to read from the book that are not in yours. So, you have prepared by reading the book, and all others, but those in the room here, will have seen several of the Black Horse and the Pale Horse series. Eventually, there will be 13 broadcasts in the series, 3 white, 2 red, 3 black, 2 pale, 1 earthquakes, and 2 on a fourth of men. Now, I have a question for you. First, I have a quote. I would like to read one thing, very brief, from the chapter of Fourth of Men, chapter 18, and it sets the table. You have read this, or at least a version of it. I altered it maybe a little. Many are intrigued by the idea of prophecy. Now, I gave a sermon called Do You Love the Truth or the Idea? Some years ago. I need to go back and review my notes because through the years, a lot of people have told me it's one of the most important sermons they believe they'd ever heard. And I've never gone back to hear the sermon myself. I know that a lot of brethren review my sermons. I wish I had time to do it. I don't have time to review my own sermons. I know it sounds strange, but I gave that title, and this begins, many are intrigued by the idea of prophecy. Of course, prophecy is part of the truth, but not the truth of prophecy. These are unable to translate mere knowledge on paper of what is to come to the awesome reality of what these prophecies actually mean for planet Earth. I emphasize words in my reading as they are in the text. That they will strike all nations with absolute sledgehammer force. To many, prophecy is a puzzle to work out, a game to play, one in which they can, quote, figure out what happens next. It is exciting, but prophecy is neither a game nor mere futuristic puzzle for the intellectually curious. Far, far from it. It is a deadly serious matter, and in all of its component parts, all recreational prophecy readers will soon wish they had looked elsewhere for stimulation and brought much more serious interest to God's Word. May that not apply, brethren, to any of us. But I suspect, knowing human nature, and after 44 plus years in the church, it will apply to some of us, and some, of course, who will hear this in 2 weeks. Now, I'd like to ask a question that sets up something that is important before we proceed. Turn over to Daniel chapter 12. Daniel 12, and we'll pick up at the beginning of the chapter. Daniel 12. And at that time, now Daniel 11 is established, it's the very end of the age, shall Michael stand up, the great prince which stands for the children of your people. Now, there's a time of such terrible, terrible trouble that one of the two remaining archangels is going to have to intervene literally to protect the church. God works through ministering spirits. When you're God, you can do it any way you want, and he chooses to use angels in many regards, many ways, many of them, hundreds of millions of them, Revelation says. But Michael plays a special role. Some believe Michael's so special he became Jesus Christ. Well, that's ridiculous, but millions believe it. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even to that time. And at that time, your people shall be delivered. Every one that shall be found written in the book. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament. They that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever. Verse 4. But you, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end. Now we're going to take a whole new look at the word end as it appears later on. You'll be fascinated, surprised, frankly, too, and maybe inspired. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. Now, in a series that I've given, and Mr. Armstrong had a booklet, Are These the Last Days? Maybe that's my title. Are We in the Last Days? Might have been his title. There are a whole series of ways that we would know, and God would want us to know, and then after he tells us the clues, would expect us to know we are in the last days. Now, I have a question for you. Actually, it's two questions that spring from verse 4. It says that in the time of the end, many shall run to and fro. Well, how does that tell you you're in the time of the end if people have always been running to and fro in the earth? Think about that. 3,000 years ago, Solomon's ships returned every 3 years with gold and ivory and other precious metals. there have been ships built for thousands of years. The Roman fleet was awesome. I've been studying a lot more about Rome, and the travel that took place 2,000 years ago is infinitely beyond anything I ever understood. I've learned a lot more about the Roman system that's coming and about the merchants that are spoken of in Revelation 17 and 18 because I've come to understand that the Roman system has always involved a tremendous amount of merchandise. A big part of understanding Babylon, I'm going to talk a little bit about this next week in part two, is to understand it is materialism. Wherever you find Babylon, you find materialism. Now, people have been on ships and in horses and wagons, on horses or in wagons or on foot for a long time. People have been running to and fro. So how is that then a sign of the end? The answer is there's an explosion of it, an ability for greater numbers to go much further, faster than ever in history. It has to be, by definition, if it's always been, an acceleration. Involving, as we understand in our age, ships, planes, trains, automobiles, you know, jets that have turned the Atlantic Ocean, as Mr. Armstrong once said, into a pond. So it has to be an acceleration or an explosion. Well, how does knowledge shall be increased tell you that we're near the end? You might think about that. You probably have never thought about it. If men have always been learning, I mean, go back to Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. From the very beginning, people have been securing more knowledge. The library in ancient Nineveh, the library also in ancient Babylon, Cairo, colossal, huge libraries, still have access to them. The ancient libraries in the Roman Empire were huge. The amount of knowledge, the total fund of mankind's knowledge has been tremendous in the past and growing all along. By definition, for 6,000 years, since Eve ate of the wrong tree, knowledge has been increased. So then how is it a sign of the end? The answer is there had to be, therefore, an explosion of knowledge. Well, in fact, we have computers. Now cell phones are computers. They're supercomputers that are doubling mankind's fund of knowledge every 2 years, maybe closer to every year now, and some believe the total fund of all of man's knowledge will, before much longer, double every 6 months. So it is the explosion of knowledge that is being spoken of. This is important to understand. Not the subject of the sermon, but certainly sets the table. Turn over to 2 Timothy chapter 3. 2 Timothy chapter 3. Here in 2 Timothy 3 is a text where similar questions arise. This know also that in the last days, now Daniel talks in terms of the time of the end, Peter and Paul, and more often in the New Testament, it uses the term last days. Peter said, in the last days scoffers shall come. Paul said, in the last days perilous times shall come. And then it lists, as you've heard me say many times, a whole series of character attributes that when you look at them, because they're all bad, reflects a near complete collapse of character. Now, look at it. For men shall be lovers of their own selves. If you study world history, I watched a special on Alexander the Great. Few people have loved their own selves more than that guy did, and he seemed to jam it into 32 years. That's all the longer he lived. There have been a lot of people, pharaohs, Caesars, and many, many, many others. These average Roman citizen would sit down to a meal. The average, let's say, upper middle class Roman citizen would sit down to a meal, much like you and I today, and there would be bread from North Africa. There would be fish from the Atlantic Ocean that was kept cool, brought back to Rome. I'm talking about in Rome, not just across Rome. They would have oysters. They would eat eels from special eel farms. Now, we wouldn't eat these things, but I'm trying to tell you what they did. They would have avocados from Spain. It's unbelievable what they had. It's unbelievable the things that Romans had. the shipping and back to running to and fro was almost unbelievable. My wife and I sat educated this week, so we spent some hours going into this. Now, covetous. Well, God had a law against coveting. Coveting's been around for a long time. And how could that have anything to do with the last days? Boasters, proud blasphemers, the book of Deuteronomy and certain of God's laws talk about those who are disobedient to parents and how you dealt with them and what you did to blasphemers and those who cursed without natural affection. That's been around for a long time. Think Sodom and Gomorrah. Truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God, having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof. Go to all the religions of the world where they have a form of godliness, but they all deny the power of the true God. So that's been going on for a long, long time. How then could it be a signal that you're at the end of the age, that dangerous times have come, that there's a near complete collapse across the whole range of different character qualities or attributes? An explosion of bad behavior, bad conduct, disobedience to God's laws, and plain sin. I'm going to give you one example so that you can appreciate, because it strikes close to home. The whole nation's talking about it. Up here in Mentor, about an hour and 10 minutes away maybe, northeast of Cleveland on the lake, there is a school, Mentor High School, where four teenagers have killed themselves because of bullying. Now, there's a lot of stories within the story. These are four relatively talented kids who were hounded to the point where they blew their brains out, hung themselves, killed themselves. And in some cases, there was so much grief over those who'd killed themselves, some of their friends who were also bullied went ahead and just did it to themselves. One school nearby. And, of course, there are lawsuits now by parents. How could one school see four deaths? Now, I must tell you, as going back to Paul there in Timothy, I never heard of this kind of bullying. I got bullied as a kid once in a while. I never heard of people killing themselves or ruthlessly bullying people in groups for long periods of time. Bullies in New York came to light this week, doing things so vile to homosexuals over a long period, one after another. It boggles the mind. Always been bullies, worse now than any I ever dealt with or than most of you would have dealt with, because probably at one time or another most of you had to address them. It's dangerous in a way that it wasn't in the past. Now, the same is true as per running to and fro, knowledge being increased, and a collapse of character. The same is true with false Christianity, war, famine, disease, earthquakes, and animal attacks. Most people think of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, and some of them can't even really discern what they are, but they have a pretty good sense that they're not good, and it's not clear, okay, what is the black horse? And they pretty much know it has something to do with famine. War is obvious. Most people don't understand what the white horse is. I've had to explain it. Disease is not clear as the pale horse. Some people understand it. Everybody knows Christ said there would be earthquakes. But how do you know? Really, the question is, how do you know that you're at the end when all of those things have been here for thousands of years? The record of history is there always have been earthquakes. War has been here since Cain killed Abel. The Assyrians have a 3,000-year history of war themselves. Go back to Nimrod. I mean, war has been here since before the flood, and Nimrod came after. There have always been famines. Remember, think of Joseph in Egypt. That was a long time ago, about 4,000 years. There have been other famous famines. Disease has been around for a long time. When Israel left Egypt, God said, if you obey me, none of the diseases of Egypt will come to you. I will keep them away from you. When I was a student at Ambassador College, we had to read a book called None of These Diseases, coming off of Exodus 15, about verses 25, 26, 27, right in there. Disease has always been around. War, famine, disease, earthquakes have always been here. Now, false Christianity has not always been here, but it's been here for 2,000 years. It started in the first century. So all of those things have been around, as have animal attacks. How then could they possibly be a sign of the end? And this is the bigger question that people always ask. It's as though Christ was too stupid to offer clues that made any sense. Wasn't Christ smart enough to realize he was telling us we'd know the sign of the end? What shall be the sign of your coming at the end of the world? He shouldn't have picked things that have always been going on for thousands of years. And the answer is, there would be an explosion of those things. And God would have to make clear to what degree there is an explosion, that they're vastly beyond anything the world has ever seen. He couldn't leave his end time servants in the dark about this. He wouldn't have to tell the original apostles, who didn't know when Christ was going to return, gone over what Paul thought, who didn't really understand the answer to their question in Matthew 24:3, what will be the sign of your coming of the end of the world? He would have to make that clear. Daniel was considered one of the three greatest men potentially who ever lived. If you look at Ezekiel 14, though Noah, Daniel, and Job were going into the tribulation, they would save none but themselves. I may have mentioned this before. He wasn't allowed to understand his book. He recorded it and wasn't allowed to understand it. People who were not used to record it, far below prophets, thousands of God's people at the end of the age are privileged to understand what the guy who was merely a scribe wasn't allowed to understand. Never mind the four horsemen. He never even heard of the four horsemen, never mind understood them. They wouldn't apply to him. There'd be no need for him to understand them. But there would always be one final generation of his people that would have to understand these things. There would be no need, again, for those who would not experience them. Job said, hide me in the grave. You know, hide me from your wrath. Keep me safe. Thousands of years before the day of the Lord. He wouldn't need to understand the details of the day of the Lord, but he knew that there was a day of the Lord coming. That's why he said what he did in Job 14. But remember me. My appointed time and my change occur, but hide me in the grave. And God does take some away from the evil to come, and he's been doing it for a long time from different evils. There have been different periods of evil. There have always been plagues. You know, think about disease for a moment. Just think about it. There have always been terrible plagues. Think Spanish flu, 1915, late 15 to early 1919. Took many tens of millions of people from a world population that was about, well, a little over 25% of today's population. So what's coming then has to be worse than that. The bubonic plague took between 40 and 200 million people from a much smaller population than existed at the end of World War I. That was bad. 40 to 200 million, nobody really knows. That's a range of up to five times as much. Pick the low number. 40 million people died when the world population was estimated to be 500 million. What if 200 million died? You see, I mean, wow. So I don't know. I doubt that it was that high. Pick 40 million. That's bad. But no one knows, and nobody really knows the population. So if things that bad happened in the past, it has to be worse. It has to be worse when the four horsemen ride. Now we're going to take a look at a couple of different things. First, I'd like you to just think of today's newspaper. I picked it up, Cleveland Plain Dealer. One of the few times I enjoy reading anything other than the sports page or what the weather's going to be is on Sabbath morning, because it has this Earth Week portion. Turn inside the first page. Here's what it says. worldwide drying may add to global warming. Now, it talks about how parts of Europe, the United States, Australia, Africa, and South America are literally giant areas. The whole continents are quietly drying out. Think drought. And then it says, while the cause for the sudden drying is not entirely understood, its consequences could be severe. I guess so. Now, if people just believed Christ, they wouldn't be surprised at that. You drop down. Insecticide meant to help boost prairie dog population. A strange and absolutely fatal disease is killing prairie dogs by the millions in Canada, which means there are other ecological problems that come off of that. The number of prairie dogs has dropped over 50%, in some areas up to 70%. They're disappearing because of this terrible disease that only rarely, it says, that seldom passes over to people. Many, many diseases start with animals. They mutate and then strike people who've never experienced them and have no immune response built in their system. Coming on down, next, World Health Organization warns of dengue fever. Dengue fever is spreading across Asia at an alarming rate, with the World Health Organization warning that cases in India are at a 20-year high. The WHO says that dengue is the most rapidly spreading mosquito-borne viral disease in the world, infecting between 50 million and 100 million people annually. And every year it's more, and it's exploding. And here's another article that was handed to me before the sermon, so I'll add it to what I mentioned. A serious flu-like illness that is transmitted by mosquitoes, dengue, can develop into dengue hemorrhagic fever, which can be fatal. If one quarter of all men are going to die as a result of the four horsemen and other things I'm going to talk about, then there are all those who have a very serious disease that will hit in such large numbers it will disrupt society and create other problems. You don't always die from dengue. Spelled D-E-N-G-U-E, but it's pronounced dengue. And it says, outbreaks in the Western Pacific region as well as cases recorded in previously unaffected areas show that action must be taken without delay, the World Health Organization said. But men are continually unable to really solve these problems. They can deal with them in a small way. Right under that is this terrible rain and flood pounding Mexico and Cuba, Hurricane Paula under that. Earthquakes felt around the world. The second strongest earthquake on record to ever hit Oklahoma broke windows and sent residents around Norman and Oklahoma City fleeing buildings. Shaking was felt northward into Kansas and as far south as Dallas-Fort Worth. India, 2 weeks of unrelenting tremors have wrecked many buildings in a western India village where residents now live outdoors in fear of further shaking. Seismologists have not said why the scores of tremors have rocked this certain village. Earth movements were also felt in New Zealand's Christchurch, aftershock zone, northern Taiwan, Fiji, eastern Bulgaria, Costa Rica, and northern Arkansas. So that's just today. Tomorrow and or next week will be another story. Now, turn over to Matthew chapter 24. Matthew 24. We're going to start looking at some things in the parallel gospels about the horsemen. I want to say again, God would not allow the final generation of his servants doing his work to be in the dark about these things. The world remains in the dark, either choosing to be so or simply never learning, and they are blissfully unaware until struck by the snare that Christ talked about in Luke 21. But we're going to look at Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. And we're going to see some interesting differences between the three accounts. I've generally taught out of Matthew 24, and that's fine. Matthew 24 and 5, because chapter 25 really is part of what Christ also said when he was talking in the Olivet Prophecy. That makes it just Matthew 24 is more than he said in Mark 13 and Luke 21. When you throw in chapter 25, it's three or four times as long as the other two accounts. So it's fine to read Matthew 24, but if you stay there and never go to Mark 13 or Luke 21, you miss things. And of course, the world has no idea that you're supposed to go to Revelation 6 for Christ's interpretation to his servants of what those three gospel accounts mean. When you put all four accounts together, all four uttered by Christ, John didn't write the book of Revelation. So in a sense, you could say Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all recorded Christ's words. Just John didn't do it in his gospel. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all add a great deal. You have to put them all together to understand why what is coming is vastly beyond anything the world has ever seen. And it is but the first relatively small wave of four waves preceding Christ's coming of punishment. Those waves would be, the second wave would be the Great Tribulation. The third would be the Day of the Lord. And the fourth is the smallest, and that's Armageddon. Now, that's part of the Day of the Lord, I understand. But when 200 million people die in about 1 minute, I count that as a wave. For them, it was pretty serious in the battle outside Jerusalem. But those four accounts, when read together, open windows of understanding. So we're going to look at all of them, and we're going to see some things. Frankly, I even saw some things that I had never seen before. And those are going to lead us to some sections of the book that now cover them that your copy, your version, does not. Chapter 24 and verse 1. And Jesus went out and departed from the temple. And his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. Now, for the moment, we won't do this very often, but it is helpful if you, for now, just this one time, we're going to jump back and look at Mark and Luke. Then we're going to stay all the way through Matthew, then all the way through Mark and Luke. But it gives you an idea why you have to put the three together. It's kind of interesting. And Jesus said to them, of course, now stay in Matthew for a moment. Jesus said to them, see you not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. That's Matthew's account. Now, Mark adds this. Chapter 13, Mark 13, verse 1. And as he went out of the temple, one of his disciples said unto him, Master, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here. So they're actually making a comment, sort of a question or a comment. And Jesus answering said unto him, see you these great buildings? There shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. Now that's not a big deal, but it shows you that the context is important. There was actually a little bit more going on there. And you're going to notice clear differences, things that are added in Matthew, Mark, and Luke that are not in the other two. Matthew, Mark, or Luke that are not in the other two. And things that are left out. And then it's all summarized when you go to Revelation. All right, now go to Luke. And Luke says this. Chapter 21. And he looked up and saw the rich men casting their gifts into the treasury. That's interesting. And he saw also a certain poor widow casting in hither two mites. Now this is actually covered, I believe, in Mark. Either Mark or Matthew, maybe both. But it's part of the previous chapter. But it's all part of what was going on. Here's this widow casting a couple of mites. And he said, of a truth I say unto you that this poor widow has cast in more than they all. For all these have of their abundance cast into the offerings of God. A lot more, but they don't feel it. But she of her penury, of her poverty, out of the little bit she has cast in all the living that she had. And as some spoke of the temple, how it was adorned with goodly stones and gifts, he said, as for these things which you behold, the days will come in the which there shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. And then they said, when shall these things be? Now they were all noting this widow lady giving a little bit of money, and at the same time these awesome, beautiful stones, an incredible masonry and work, in the temple, and commenting on that when Christ said it was all going to be destroyed. Don't focus on it. All of this beauty is going to be destroyed. Now, that's not a big deal. It's just, it shows you that you have to put it all together and you see more of the picture. So let's go back to Matthew 24 and we'll stay there till we're ready to go to Mark. All right, verse 3, Matthew 24. I'm not going to stop a lot. I'm going to read and I'll comment on a few interesting things. Now, I will say this. The order of these three Gospels, add John 65 years later, Book of Revelation, is important. I'm not going to read them in their proper order. I'm going to go Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but I'm actually going to throw in John, and I'm going to go Matthew, John, Mark, and Luke, and I'll explain why in a moment. You'll understand. But there is a reason they are given in the order that they are. The gospel accounts come alive with the book of Revelation. As he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of your coming and of the end of the world?" Now, it's interesting. That's the first of five times in Matthew 24 you see the word end. And they don't all come from the same Greek word. And the words they do come from are fascinating. For instance, go on over to verse 31. Verse 31. Speaking of Christ's return, he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds and from one end of heaven to the other. Now, for those of us living in this area, that's a particularly interesting Greek word. The word end is akron, spelled and pronounced like the city 5 miles away. Akron, that's the word. And it means extremity. But it's not what the word for end means earlier in the chapter when we'll read it four times. That's a totally different word. And it's why sometimes you have to look at the Greek, but you don't have to be a Greek scholar or God couldn't use the weak of the world. But here akron means extremity, tip, top, uttermost part. Now, if you understand that, you'll realize why Akron, Ohio is named what it is. It is the county seat of Summit County. Well, why is it Summit County? Well, because it's right there where the what's called the Great Divide occurs. I've mentioned this before, but at a certain point right in Akron, the water flows into Lake Erie and goes over the falls, up the St. Lawrence, and out to the North Atlantic. On a place at a certain point on the south side of Akron, the water kind of drains into the Tuscarawas River, which eventually flows, I believe, into the Muskingum River, which flows into the Ohio and the Mississippi and lands in the Gulf. And there is actually a place on the south side of Akron where the water in the Tuscarawas River, a lot of people have drowned there because it's very dangerous, water falls into this area where, it's strange, the water actually parts. And it goes two different directions. And they had to put an iron wall in it because you can actually look into it and see the water flow in two different directions in the same river because they put a canal there. You can go downtown and see remnants of that canal. And it passes from north to south through the city, connecting, in effect, Montreal with New Orleans. Summit County, Akron, end, tip, top, uttermost part. Well, okay, you can understand end there. It has a meaning, doesn't it? But it's not what end is talking about in the earlier part of the chapter, in any of the four times it appears, because it appears in verse 6, Christ talks about wars and rumors of wars. All these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. Verse 13, but he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. Now, not only is it different from end in verse 31, it is a fascinating word. Turn over to Romans chapter 10. This is the first, I think, fascinating point of, I hope, many you find you take from this sermon. Turn to Romans chapter 10 and verse 4. And there are several other words translated end in the New Testament, by the way. I don't have time to go into them. One, I think, is the entire consummation, the end. There's another place written actually right in Matthew where a different Greek word, theuna, I believe it is. Okay, here we go. This is a place where you find end in Paul's writing. Now, verse 3, for they being ignorant of God's righteousness, Romans 10, and going about to establish their own righteousness, have not submitted themselves unto the righteousness of God. For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone that believes. Now, typically, the deceived and deceiving ministers of the world will say, see there, Christ is the end of the law. The law stops with Christ. He nailed it to the cross. It's done away. Until you look up the word end. And of course, when you look up the word end, you find it has a tremendous meaning. And it's the Greek word telos, T-E-L-O-S, T-E-L-O-S, from which comes telescope, television, and so forth. It means, here's the word translated, the goal or the aim to set out for a definite point or goal. The point aimed at as a limit, a conclusion. So none of us believe that the word end there means anything close to the law came to an end. Right? But it says end. He's the goal of the law. He's the aim. He was perfect. We're to copy him, to walk in his steps. He's the personification in the flesh of how you keep the law. The context in Romans is people going about setting, you know, to build their own righteousness. They were self-righteous. And they were ignorant of the righteousness of God. The righteousness of God is defined in Christ's life. That's the goal, not what you can do to impress God with, you know, human works, human effort, all done on human steam and human power. So end is pretty important there, isn't it? Now, it so happens that the word telos is the exact same word in Matthew 24, found four times. And we need to think differently, brethren, from now on. We need to let God explain this to us, so to speak. God reveals it to us. Let's take his understanding and it will inspire you. Now, this is not my main point here, but it's a big one. And so I have to show all the different places here. Now you understand it's telos, it's not theuna, and it's not akron. It's telos, and there are others besides, by the way. It is telos. It's the aim. All right. We think of the work continuing until the end come. But Christians, those listening to Christ, and it wasn't for them, remember, it's for us, are supposed to understand we continue to do the work till we hit the goal. The point aimed at as a limit, a conclusion. Not the end of things. First of all, you know it isn't the end of the world. So you know, end right there in verse 3 isn't talking about the world blowing up, which is often what people think, or the end of all people on earth. It's the goal. It's the aim. You endure to the goal. Now all of a sudden, verse 13 has more meaning. You don't endure to the end. It's the goal. Now everybody understands goals, short, medium, long, and very long range goals. Your life should be filled with a lot of goals. The greatest goal is therefore the one talked about here. You have to endure to the end to be saved. The greatest goal is salvation. Short of that, the second greatest goal ought to be verse 14. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the goal come. So that's a goal within the goal. If the very long range goal is the kingdom, within it, to get to the final goal, you got to get to that goal. But it's not the end of the world. It's not even the time Christ returns, because we know that the end means 1,335 days. So we have a goal to get to the 1,335 days, and it makes more sense now that you find the word end, because that's the end of the work. But you have to actually keep on going, of course, to be saved. Now let's go back and continue to read and pick up some other things. And Jesus answered and said unto them for the first time, take heed that no man deceive you. Four times you find the word deceive there. For many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. All of this speaks to us, not those men. Now, they've always been deceivers, so would it be helpful for them? Sure it would. But remember, it's in our age where there is an explosion of it. Now, one of the questions is going to become, because I have some fascinating stuff to show you that Christ said that involves, again, some portions of the book you didn't read, but I'll read to you. There is a time period involved here. Deception explodes. False ministers and what they do, number of churches, doctrinal ideas, even false miracles explode. We now know that. Wars grow much worse, as do famines and disease. And we're going to find out Christ said more about earthquakes than just and earthquakes in various places. That's one of the things you're going to learn before we're done. He said more than that about the nature of those earthquakes. And you'll find it's one of the reasons you don't just read Matthew, by the way. All right, so there's deception. You shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. All right, we now know what the end is not yet. Now understand, people living at the end would see terrible wars, and it would be the first point at which you might think, it can't get worse. So Christ would, as any other instructor would insert at that point, not necessarily after deception or after the buildings are thrown down, but he would at that point say, no, it's not the end. Now that's instruction to you. You're being told that when war explodes all over the world, that it's not the end. And remember, it has to get really bad because we've had a lull since World War I and II. War took a general downturn after that and then has been accelerating ever since. So whatever comes has to be infinitely beyond World War I and II, which were total wars, the end of the second of which involved nuclear weapons. Now we're seeing, chemical weapons and biological weapons. We saw chemical weapons used in World War I. You've seen biological weapons used. Saddam Hussein used them on the Kurds in the north, killed many thousands. And there have been biological weapons used at other times since, their invention, if you will. All right, for nation shall rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. Why, war itself even gets worse and is still not near the end. So he inserts it, interestingly, in the middle of the discussion about wars. Kingdom against kingdom means empire against empire. In other words, it's like you've got not just a nation or within a nation, a civil war, because war, in essence, operates at, four levels. You have bombings, you have a civil war, that's an all-out war between a nation. There's civil wars all over the world, there's lots of them now. I talk about them in the book. We once fought a civil war here 150 years ago, almost. And then there are wars between nations, that's worse. You have to have at least two nations to have that war. But then there's kingdom against kingdom, so that gets even worse because a kingdom typically would be a way of describing an empire. Now, some kingdoms could be one nation, but typically Christ differentiates them. Now, nation there against nation is ethnos, so that can be a civil war. But kingdom against kingdom could also then be a nation against a nation or a group of allies, World War I and II, against another group of allies in World War I or II. So it ratchets up. That's the point. Christ doesn't tell you a lot, but if you stop and read slowly, one of the greatest rules of Bible study, it is important. You see things. And there shall be famines, that's all he says, and pestilences and earthquakes in various places. Now he pauses and cuts in on himself again at the natural point an instructor would after he just blew everybody away, to use the vernacular. What? Because they would have all known these things were happening. Christ wasn't talking to 12 people who couldn't think, read, or hear. They would have expected it to get much worse. They would understand that. He wouldn't have to say that. Any thinking person would know if something's been going on since the garden, or all these conditions have been going on since creation, that saying they're a sign of the end mean they get worse. And therefore, they're going to think, wait a minute, is this the end? So he cuts in a second time and says, these are the beginning of sorrows, the startup. But we understand it's talking to us, not them. Keep that in mind. So Christ is telling you. He's telling me. For now the second time he's cutting in and saying, that's not the end. And still, after I told you all this, it's still just the beginning. He told a whole lot more and said, now we're just at the beginning. So when he said it's not the end yet, the first time we hadn't even gotten to the end of the beginning. Do you understand? But that isn't the way people would receive it. They think, I've never seen anything like this. And you and I are supposed to understand Christ is telling us it's going to get beyond anything anybody has ever seen while the work is still going on, because that comes up in a moment. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then shall many be offended, and shall betray one another, and shall hate one another. And many false prophets shall rise, and shall, here it is the third time, deceive many. These are important clues. And because lawlessness shall abound, that's setting the table to read later what Paul was inspired to write. Last days, perilous times, why character breakdown. Everybody is a law unto themselves. There's plenty of law, right? Everybody's a law unto themselves. Never been so much law. They just won't keep the laws that have been collectively agreed on by societies. Or in the case of Europe, we might add continents, because there will be European law soon, and there already is. And the love of many shall wax cold. Now, the discerning person at the end of the age looks to see how much of this is happening now. All right. But he that shall endure to the end, the same shall be saved. He cuts in a third time and said, now, you hang on. This is it. We're not done yet. Okay. Christ has cut in on himself three times. And when he does it, he is talking to you and to me. Now, once is usually enough. And you could theorize you don't have to say it at all. If you just get to verse 14, you say it once, because he mentions it for the fourth time there. But he's telling you, because people will have a tendency to be frantic. This is one of the greatest reasons for Luke 18:8. When the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? If he finds it, I've always said it'll only be in his people, nowhere else. So he's talking to his people. You're not talking to good Lutherans or how it's going in the Episcopalian or Baptist church. He's talking to his people. It's a question because it's not answered yet. How many people will panic and just go to pieces when we're not even at the end of the beginning? And then once you get to the beginning, now it really heats up and you still have to endure to the end. The same shall be saved. A couple other places that verse is found, I think. It's the same word, telos, there. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations. Whew, and here we are. And then shall the end come, the goal. But it's not the ultimate goal, because the ultimate goal, of course, is salvation. But the ultimate goal for us now to get to salvation is doing the work. The sermon isn't about doing the work. We'll get more into that next week to some degree. But this is the fourth and last time in this chapter, other than Akron in verse 31, which is totally different, that you see the word end. And it really is the end of the work. And we have gone through all of what people have never in 6,000 years seen on such a grand scale, which, by the way, is happening to an earth that is totally interconnected, where anything that happens in any corner of the world is known about 5 minutes later, and maybe with 4 minutes left over, because of cell phones, often with pictures of it. And so you've got the greatest number of people living in what has been called a global village, all interconnected in so many ways, television and computers and cell phones, you know, the internet and so forth. There'll be tremendous panic, but God's people cannot panic. I hope this is a hallmark sermon that helps you, that your eye is now the end comes when you've finished the work and not before it. You don't have to worry about salvation if you're not willing to do that. Now, I understand there are Laodiceans who will be saved who didn't do the work. But they will do a certain work. You will find, and I've covered it in other places in the tribulation, they will do a certain work of witnessing. It's not a work I want to do, but it's a work they're going to have to do when they don't take the mark, and that's a different subject. But verse 15 is, here comes the abomination of desolation. So it's over. I mean, the work is over. Now end means end. Then shall the end come. All right, we're done with Matthew. And we're going to go to John, only it's the book of Revelation. But I can call it John for the sake of illustrating that all four of the gospel writers wrote about it. Nobody believes that Matthew was writing. It was Christ's words. Nobody believes that Mark and Luke were writing, or Christ's words. Nobody believes it's not in God's church. They don't believe it's John's writings. It is, of course, Christ's words that you come to in Revelation 6. Again, the book explained was Christ interpreting. Now, after all the other apostles are dead, what must have been for a generation beyond them? He's interpreting Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Why interpret it 65 years later? It didn't make any difference. As long as he interpreted it and explained it clearly for the final generation, the first generation wasn't going to understand it. It wasn't for them. They were sort of like Daniel. They understood certain additional things by having been tutored by Christ personally for 3.5 years, but it didn't apply to them. That's why Paul could say, "We which are alive and remain shall be caught up with them." Now he figured out later, whoops, no, that's not going to happen now, but I don't know what all he learned. He learned more about the man of sin and there's coming a falling away, but he didn't understand. So you come to Christ's really fulfilling what he would have to do with his final servants. Now, the book opens with the statement to show his servants what must come to pass. Nobody else. His servants have a job to do. They're on planet Earth for a totally different reason than everybody else who's going through the exact same things. Chapter 6 and verse 1. And I saw when the Lamb opened, one of the seals. Chapters 4 and 5 talk about these seven seals. It's a serious sermon, so think of it this way, pun intended or not intended. Revelation 6 seals your understanding. It seals the deal, literally, of all that we've read so far and are still going to read, because it shows the sequencing of things coming exactly as they're shown in the three gospel accounts. All right, seals, and I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder. One of the four beasts saying, "Come and see," and I saw, behold, a white horse. Don't need to say anything other than read this because you know it. He that sat on him had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer. The world thinks this is Protestantism, and they have so many different goony ideas about this that some of them think it's the true Christ, or they think it's the apostles in the first century. They don't know what it is. And it's none of those things because false Christianity has deceived them. They're living proof that the white horse rides, because the people teaching them what the white horse is are false in their understanding. They teach them a wrong thing. So why would the world seeking to understand the white horse ever have a chance at understanding it when they go to the white horse and rider for instruction about it? So that's not hard to figure. War is pretty easy. And when he opened the second seal, I heard the second beast say, "Come and see." And there went out another horse that was red, and power was given to him to sat thereon to take peace from the earth. Well, when you take peace, you have war and its absence. So that's easy. And that they should kill one another, and there was given unto him a great sword. But it's said differently enough that, A, the world won't connect it to Matthew 24, but God's servants will see it speaking right to them, and it makes perfect sense. These are sequential conditions, one after another. Seals opened. Now, how do we know they all occur at the end? I will close the door on that for all time. For all those who think this has been going on for 2,000 years, I hope I've already given you a strong proof in the introduction about Daniel and what Paul said, but I'm going to give you the ultimate proof that these all happen at the end in just a moment. Well, in a while, before we're done. All right, to take peace from the earth, and that they should kill one another, and there was given unto him a great sword. And when he had opened a third seal, I heard the third beast saying, "Come and see." And I beheld, and lo, a black horse, and he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hands. I explained this on last night's broadcast. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts say, "A measure of wheat for a penny, and three measures of barley for a penny." In other words, it's one denarius. Basically, 2,000 years ago, that's a whole day's wage for one day's food. it's rationing, and the thinking mind knows it's talking about famine. The person who connects it to Matthew 24 and Mark and Luke and knows that the Bible interprets itself knows it's famine. It's easy. And see that you hurt not the oil and the wine. Food is precious. You know, we're entering a time when God says people are going to throw their gold and silver in the streets. Never in history, to my knowledge, at least certainly not in my lifetime or American history, have more people been buying gold than now against the collapsing economy. You might just think about that. You can't eat gold. One of the reasons they're going to throw it in the street is they're looking for something to eat and they realize they trusted in the wrong hedge against bad times to come. People buy gold believing it's a hedge against better times to follow. But in the last age, in the worst time of all time, people will buy more gold than ever and they'll throw it away because there is no good time to come until Christ returns. Okay, that all hopefully makes sense. And when he had opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth beast say, "Come and see." Now look, understand, each time it's come and see, it's not the concealing, it's the revealing. It's not the closing up, as Daniel was told, it's the opening up. We're supposed to see it. So look, it's God telling you, talking to John, but God telling you, come on over and look at this. Each time, come and see. And I beheld, and lo, a pale horse, sickly looking. It doesn't say pestilence, but again, the person reading Matthew, knowing that Christ is going to interpret what he meant there to the patient Bible student in God's church, he would have to explain it, and here it is, pale horse. And his name that sat on him was death, not pestilence, but it is pestilence. And hell, that's the grave, followed him, and power was given unto them over the fourth part of the earth to kill with, here it is, given unto them. Now it's speaking collectively of all four, all of them, given unto them, white, red, black, and pale horse. You got to notice that. It's kind of like that lives by the sword shall perish by the sword. No, shall perish with the sword. It's important to notice one single word there, them. The four together over the fourth part of the earth. Well, what do you mean the fourth part of the earth? Because, Mr. Pack, you titled your chapter The Fourth of Men. Well, the fourth part of the earth is explained by to kill with sword. It's not killing trees. It's not killing daisies or dandelions or puppy dogs. It's killing people. To kill with sword and with hunger. Oh, no doubt now what the black horse is and what the balances are. And with death. Now, pestilence is so bad that it's simply described as death. The pale horse tells you it's pestilence and to kill with just death. And when you read some of the accounts coming up, when you've read in the book about just how Spanish flu would take people in hours during World War I and certain other forms of death that plague brings, it's so horrible. Some pictures of people with smallpox, it's just death. It's awful. Ebola, people's organs turn to liquid in Ebola. It's horrific what happens. I read a book about it one time. And with the beasts of the earth. All right. Now, that's awful. But death is a broader range of things. You're going to find one of the things it includes, of course, because it does say death and does not say pestilence per se. That'd be the greatest part of it. It includes earthquakes. It includes certain other things that we'll come to in Mark that we've not come to yet. But it also includes now the beasts of the earth, the four sore judgments of Ezekiel. Let me just read this for a moment. Some other scriptures. God is very, very graphic about the beasts of the earth. You have to go to other places. In this case, the Old Testament. And I'm read these before, but I'll read them again. Wherefore a lion out of the forest shall slay them, and a wolf of the evening shall spoil them. A leopard shall watch over their cities. This is in Jeremiah chapter 5. Everyone that goes out thence shall be torn in pieces, because their transgressions are many and their backslidings are increased. Ezekiel says this, if I cause noisome, each bad or evil beast, to pass through the land, and they spoil it so that it be desolate, that no man may pass through because of the beasts, wild, fierce animals. People just afraid to go outside cities. Now, Leviticus 26, I, God, will also send wild beasts among you, which shall rob you of your children. Parents afraid to put children out and destroy your cattle and make you few in number. Does that sound like just an occasional grizzly bear attack or somebody who dies because a rabid skunk bit them? No, way beyond that. Children disappear, livestock are killed, the human population dwindles. I'm reading from the book. Finally, notice what God also states through Jeremiah. And I, God, will appoint over them four kinds, says the Lord, the sword to slay and the dogs to tear, the fowls of the heaven and the beasts of the earth to devour and destroy. Now, statistics show that the populations of rats, rabbits, chipmunks, mice, deer, coyotes, squirrels, possums, and skunks are multiplying. So are bears, wolves, and mountain lions, and so are now wild bands of roving domestic dogs. A guy was just torn to pieces by all his own dogs here a few weeks ago in certain communities, which when released or escaped, find each other and naturally revert to their hunter's pack instinct. Men know this and become extremely dangerous. Adding this element to the devastation trailing natural disasters, I'm reading from the Fourth of Men, seen in the last chapter, is all the more sobering to contemplate. Even though I've been aware of and studied these prophecies for almost 45 years, they are always just as nightmarish to consider. Their weight and force upon the thinking mind never lessens with time. One is left with whether he believes God. Some will, some won't. All right, now we can go on over to Mark. We read the beginning of it. So verse 4, Mark 13, 4. Tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign when all these things shall be fulfilled? It may be that one asked about it, things being fulfilled. Others said, well, the end of the world. Jesus answering them began to say, take heed lest any man deceive you. Now, if you put the gospel accounts together, that's the fifth time you find deceive. The fourth time in Matthew was later down around verses maybe around 23 or 4, something like that. I didn't read it because we stopped before we got to it. Many shall come in my name, saying, I'm Christ, and shall deceive many. Then it talks about wars and rumors of wars. Don't be troubled, for such things must needs be, but the end shall not be yet. We are being told, not three times in one account, but for those reading the whole Bible, we're now being told for the fourth time. Nation shall rise against nation. Kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be earthquakes in various places, and famines, and troubles. Where's pestilences? It just says troubles. Now that's interesting, because that's not talking about disease. But we know from Matthew that it is including disease. Troubles that bring death. Disease isn't used in John or Revelation, but here you find troubles. Troubles. Now that's an interesting word, and I want to read it to you. But first, I want to read a kind of a section that leads up to it. As this most critical turning point in prophecy, as the world explodes toward the brink of the fifth seal of the Great Tribulation, we ask a sobering question that should be on every reader's mind. How far, to what degree, have the seals of false Christianity, war, famine, and pestilence come to bear? You've already seen that the first four seals are now open. The previous five chapters, still reading in the Fourth of Men, the previous five chapters thunder this undeniable fact, just as evidence that we have not yet entered the time of great tribulation, such as we're not since the beginning of the world. The world now rests on the fulcrum of these great prophecies, the tipping point. How critical is the question of the timeline surrounding the fulfillment of the first four seals? Understand, the arrival of the Great Tribulation hinges entirely on the coming unlocking of the four seals preceding it. It's the fifth seal for a reason. Until the horrors that these seals bring claim a quarter of all men, the tribulation will not come. The depth to which the first four seals have been opened is therefore the key indicator of our proximity to the tribulation, to discerning the correct mile marker on God's prophetic timeline. What could be more important to comprehend in regard to time? I'll ask all of you that. You read it in the book. I don't know if that part was there. Before examining the facts surrounding this question of the precise transition between the first four and the fifth seals, A critical warning specific to this juncture in prophecy must be made. As the age draws to a close, brethren, this is a great warning for all of us. If you don't get this, the rest of the sermon doesn't make any difference to you. As the age draws to a close, self-deception and pursuit of materialism has grown so great that mankind cannot comprehend what is presently occurring the world over, what is happening right now. Now look, right now, there are reasons people are missing this. 9 million people are starving to death every year now. That's 24,000 people per day. You understand? Wadsworth is a city of about 24,000 people. A Wadsworth disappears every day on earth. We're about 24,000 here, about 15 when I got here. But it's scattered so you don't see it. If whole cities of 24,000 were disappearing, just, you know, if Wadsworth was gone tomorrow and everybody in it, the world would take note, but it's sprinkled. It's here and there. 30 million are dying of disease every year. That's 39 million. All right, that's 3 1/3 times as many to disease. That would be a city of close to 100,000. Not quite. Maybe more like 80,000, something like that. I guess be exactly 80,000. Now, if a city of 80,000 were lost anywhere, it would be catastrophic. You'd almost think a small nuclear weapon went off or a dirty bomb. The world would be utterly focused on it, but because they're sprinkled all over the world, they don't see it. 46 million babies are aborted. Well, nobody's going to count that, although that falls under death. Taking the total to 85 million, now that's annually, 46 million, because, hey, that's legal. That's mass murder. As I heard one man say last night, if you kill a baby eagle by destroying an eagle's egg, you will go to prison. But if you slaughter an innocent, defenseless baby in a mother's womb, you have kept the law. That's how twisted and broken the world is. So the world's not looking for this slaughter, unless it might be an eagle, you see, or a cougar cub. It was left alone in California a few years back when the mother was killed because the mother had killed a woman. And the cougar cubs received 10 times as much money donated from people to take care of them than the little child, the jogging mother, who was killed by the cougar, was sent. 10 times. What's wrong with this picture? The world isn't seeing it. It's blurred. It's a world where while 39 million people will die this year, the whole world will think about 33 miners. Over a million people for every one miner who got out of the bottom of that thing will focus for days and days and talk about those 33 guys. Who won't talk about what they did because they're all going to write a book and make money. They won't, there's a lot of what they say, they're not going to talk about it. Because they come up, well, we're all focused on them. They're going to come up and say, hey, baby, we can cash this in. There's big bucks here. And we listen to what psychologists think and who's going to have claustrophobia on the 20-minute ride up and what they did and who's got a mistress on the outside and who's going to get married. The whole world. While over 1 million people die horribly, lost to the consciousness of America. And you can't let that happen to you. Because an earthquake does not strike here. Because a shell doesn't land in the city and on a house with people in it. You know, oh, war has come to Wadsworth or wherever you live across the world, brethren, speaking beyond this room. You can't let it get lost on you. 250 million people died in the last century because of war. But if you didn't die, and it's over, we're not even in the last century anymore, 1900 to 1999, it's sort of, is it real? Well, some people don't even think the Holocaust occurred. There are world leaders who don't think the Holocaust occurred. One of them was received like a conquering king in Lebanon a couple days ago. And he stood a few miles from the nation he wants to destroy, not believing 6 million of them died in the last war. The world's upside down. Now let me keep reading here. Most cannot fathom a human death toll approaching 2 billion. This is a fourth of men. It is beyond their scope of comprehension. And despite the undeniable fact that tens of millions are perishing every year now, and it's accelerating, they ignore, knowingly or unknowingly, these horrifying numbers. They simply are not looking for the carnage and are not recognizing it when they see it. So great is this self-deception that at the tail end of the fourth part of the earth fulfillment, when the rising body count is greatest, earth's inhabitants will be lulled into believing the soothing lies of the devil's agents, soon to declare peace, peace, when there is no peace. Now here's the point. Will you be among the undiscerning and gullible, or deny the undeniable? No, a lot of God's people will. They won't have faith on the earth. They'll go to pieces. And a lot of them, half of those in the final era, take the mark. Or we wake up to the Bible's clear warnings and to the cold, hard, concrete statistics screaming from newspapers, magazines, journals, television stations, and websites the world over. Understand, though, conditions will, to a degree, seem normal, or no thinking mind would take any such peace, peace declaration seriously. Here's one way it might happen. It doesn't hit the nations of Israel until the tribulation, so it's not here yet. They're not going to take it seriously. And to other parts of the world where there's always been more problems, a simple acceleration in places where, again, people have seen it, grown up with it, war, famine, disease, poverty, pollution, illiteracy, and all the other problems of the third world, it might just seem like another day at the office, but a little worse. That's why this is the beginning of sorrows. But since it's something that God's people might be looking for, having never seen it this bad before, because it's never happened like this, where one quarter of mankind, one of the greatest population of all time exists, die, you would expect people to panic. But not God's people. They better not. They got to get to the goal. Now it says, but take heed to yourselves, for they shall deliver you up to the councils. The work isn't mentioned here yet. And in the synagogues you shall be beaten, and you shall be brought before rulers and kings for my sake, for a testimony against them. And the gospel must first be preached among all nations. Now, Christ deliberately throws it down into the middle of this statement, because it picks up, but when they shall deliver you up, lead you and deliver you up, take no thought before in what you'll speak, neither do you premeditate whatsoever should be given to you in that hour, that speak you. For it is not you that speak, but the Holy Spirit. It takes faith to believe that. And if you can't believe that God will do that through you, then you really limit God, which was one of the sins of Israel. God can speak through Balaam's ass to Balaam. He can talk through you or anybody else that he chooses. Brother shall betray the brother to death, the father the son, and so forth. And then it comes down to verse 14, after it says, you must endure unto the end, telos again, the same shall be saved, it says the abomination is set up. So that's pretty short. You don't go as many verses there. Starts in verse 4 and ends in verse 14. So Matthew starts with the question in verse 3, and you get to verse 14, so it's a little bit longer. Although it says a lot more after it here and there. Now, the gospel must first be preached, so the gospel is preached before we're delivered up. Do you understand? That's why it's in the middle of it, so you have to realize, well, wait a minute, why is it right in the middle of we're being delivered? Well, it's because it says it must first be preached, key word. All right, that's all we're going to see in Mark, except I want to explain what troubles mean. Remember, I said we're going to come to troubles. Okay. Now recognize that Mark's account of the Olivet prophecy, this is added to the book, so your book wouldn't have this, as a word not found in either Matthew's or Luke's account. Instead of mentioning pestilences, which both Matthew and Luke do, as well as does Revelation 6 in regard to the pale or sickly horse, Mark says this, for nation shall rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, earthquakes in various places, and there shall be famines and troubles. The Greek word translated troubles means disturbance, that is, of water roiling, or of a mob, sedition, trouble. This word brings to mind riots, civil uprisings, protests, violent crimes, all over Europe right now, by the way. And we're going to see more of it in America, and probably soon. And gang war, as well as a range of difficulties, some severe, that would come from floods. Just think Pakistan in the summer of 2010, and probably tremendous storms such as hurricanes, cyclones, and typhoons, all forms of roiling water. Mark's gospel indicates that these things will also grow worse. You probably never saw that. I never looked it up and never thought about it. And each will bring its own additional death toll toward the one-fourth of all humanity that is losing their lives in this first wave. Remember, the four together bring death. And that involves now troubles, and we already know it involves earthquakes and commotions and other things. Okay, now let's go to Luke 21. We'll pick it up in verse 5. And as some spoke of the temple, how it was adorned with goodly stones and gifts, he said, for all these things will be thrown down one upon another. Verse 7, and they asked him, saying, Master, but when shall these things be, and what sign will there be when these things shall come to pass? Okay, interesting there, not fulfilled or not end. Might want to look it up in the Greek and see what it means. But there's different ones asking different questions. You know, in a conversation where you've got 12 very powerful leaders, so you don't have 11 church mice and one asking questions of Christ, so there may have been different ways that it was brought up. And he said, take heed that you be not deceived, for many shall come in my name, saying, I'm Christ, and the time draws near, go you not therefore after them. Now it doesn't say, and they shall deceive many. If you only read Luke, you wouldn't know that. Matthew and Mark tell you that. He just says, don't follow them. Though, of course, God's people in the 20th century stampeded after them. But when you shall hear of wars and commotions, now Matthew and Mark didn't mention commotions, and I've explained what commotions meant. We've talked about that. It's more like terrorist bombings and terrible other things. Different than troubles, but commotions. Be not terrified. Now, that's interesting. What is the goal of terrorists, which is kind of a low-temperature war? The goal is to create terror. Now, Christ would know this is coming. The disciples wouldn't. But we would today, I think, find it pretty easy to understand why would say don't be terrified in the wake of commotions, because we live in a time when there are terrorists. And the natural reaction would be to be terrified. So don't. There's a lot of chatter right now. The Homeland Security Department says that something is coming. Just a few days ago, sitting in open court, this guy that tried to blow up the Jeep in Times Square had an absolute smugness and a cold confidence about soon many more actions are going to take place. A couple days ago, Janet Napolitano was talking about this. It's all over the news. Something is coming. They're not going to go for the big and the spectacular. They're going to start hitting in small ways more often, getting people to believe it could happen where I live. Not necessarily big buildings falling down. All right, let's keep reading. These things must first come to pass, but the end is not by and by. Then shall nation rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and great earthquakes shall be in various places, and famines and pestilences. Now first, let's stop. That says great earthquakes. The other two places do not say great earthquakes. You might ask yourself, did you ever notice the difference? Let's read it, because that's something else I added to the book that you don't have, but we'll read it now. Immediately following his warning about false Christianity, war, famine, and disease, Jesus also warned of another pivotal sign that would precede his return. He listed a fifth condition. There shall be earthquakes in various places. Now, this says that earthquakes would be scattered here and there, but must also mean they would increase in both frequency and intensity. You don't have to even believe me on this one, as his second coming drew near. Think, since earthquakes have existed throughout history, their mere ongoing presence could not indicate the time of the end. I've covered this, but I'm rereading it. By all honest accounts, earthquakes are coming more often and are more severe, and this will greatly worsen. As we proceed, you will be left to believe scientists are God. I showed some say we don't know, some scientists say they're worse, some say they're still the same. I showed that in the book. Jesus himself clears up the question of intensity. the severity of earthquakes at the end. Soon, scientists will no longer be able to doubt. Slightly different from Matthew's and Mark's accounts, Jesus' statement in Luke adds a very important element about these earthquakes, how powerful they will be. Notice, and great earthquakes shall be in various places, and famines and pestilences. First, notice that the word translated great is megas. Now, if somebody's mega rich or a megastar, you know, in Hollywood, we all know what it means, big. And in the Greek, it means big, great, high, large, loud, mighty, and strong. Take this word for exactly what it means and what Christ intended. Think of these as mega earthquakes. It's about intensity and frequency. Storms, everybody knows, storms are growing worse. It doesn't make any difference if it's global warming or not. God said it would come. What difference does it make why five continents are suddenly discovered to be kind of drying out? What difference does it make? It doesn't make any difference. It's that it's happening, not the scientific reason for it. What difference does it make why prairie dogs are dying? What's important is that they're dying, or that bats and bees are dying and they can't pollinate crops and we're going to run short of food. That's important. God said it would happen. These are quakes of tremendous magnitude that would result in terrible, widespread destruction. Not as bad as the five in Revelation, though. This differentiates the final period of earthquakes, when they come more often and are more destructive, from relatively average, in quotes, quakes, coming also farther apart in all previous periods of history. It becomes evident that the same would be true of volcanic activity. But a second point is seen by comparing Luke and Mark to Matthew's account. The latter lists earthquakes at the end of war, famine, and disease. Luke and Mark list them before these things. The point is obvious. They will occur throughout the final years when false Christianity, war, famine, and disease will have grown much worse. You got to look at what's said and where and how. All right, so let's continue reading. Now here's where Christ throws in a curveball to confuse people who are not obeying him, because a good understanding have all they that keep or do the commandments. Psalm 111:10. And fearful sights and great signs shall there be from heaven. But before all these, they shall lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and into prisons. Now, we had quite an interesting discussion in the council, being brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. Now, that presents quite a problem. And it shall turn to you for a testimony. Before all these, they shall lay their hands on you. Excuse me, before war, famine, disease, pestilence, earthquakes, commotions, troubles, before all that is when we're delivered up? That's what it appears to say, doesn't it? Look at the end of verse 11. Christ in Mark mentioned the gospel right in the middle of those two things. The work doesn't end. We learned, because we read Matthew and Mark first, the gospel is preached and published in all nations before the end. The work doesn't end before the war, famine, and disease occurs according to those gospels. But here it looks like it says, before all these they shall lay their hands on you. Christ would have explained in the other accounts, it's before the fearful sights and great signs shall there be from heaven. What is that? That's the sixth seal. That's the heavenly signs. So obviously then, before all these fearful sights and great signs, they shall deliver you up. Not before the war, famine, disease, pestilence, and earthquakes. So it's before all these things in the second half of verse 11. It's important, because if you're reading quickly, oh, all that bad stuff happens when we're gone. The tribulation is when the lukewarm brethren are delivered up. That's the fifth seal. So that would be ahead of the sixth seal, which is the heavenly signs, wouldn't it? But Christ says it in a way to let the sloppy or careless reader get confused. They'll lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and into prisons, being brought before kings. I'll give you a mouth, what to speak. And he adds things that Matthew and Mark don't say. You'll be betrayed, verse 16, by parents and brethren and kinsfolk. Christ says this over and over. Many of us are going to be betrayed out of fear. He shall be hated of all men for my name's sake. This is a huge, huge work that is completed through a period where 1/4 of all human beings die. Hundreds of millions will die. And of course, the world will take note of what they can't now see at, let's say, 39 million a year, starving and disease. Make that 10 times as much. And of course, how many are dying from war? I didn't even mention war in that statistic. 250 million died in the last century due to war. Now, this is important because we've got some powerful things to draw to a conclusion here. We're not done. We're getting close. But it says when you get to verse 19, chapter 21, in your patience possess you your lives. And that's in context of verses 8 to 11. All through everything that happens, the war, famine, disease, troubles, mega earthquakes. Think Haiti, by the way. Think China. Think so many other places. Remember, more often and more intense. I mean, how could a thinking person not see there's more earthquakes? There's 4 every day in Japan that are measured. 1,500 every year just in Japan. But they're not, they don't all look like Haiti. Where, oh, by the way, in the wake of that terrible earthquake, housing problems have been largely unaddressed. Food supply, disease, terrible problems occurring there. So if 88,000 die in a typical year of earthquakes, and that's going to rise, and that's the number, how many then die in the wake of the earthquake because they starve to death or disease takes them? Or the country breaks down into civil war because that took the capital of Haiti. And when you hear those things, you just say it's death. The guy on the 4th horse has a sickle. He's not carrying microbes in his hand, although that's a big part of it. Death from all kinds of ways. They all these ways cross-pollinate with one another, as do volcanoes. Volcanoes don't allow food into Britain while you have famine. And wherever you have famine, you have disease because you have compromised immune systems. You must see this series as it continues on the broadcast. And, of course, it just continues on down. When you see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh. Luke doesn't even mention the work. If you studied the book of Luke, you know, you wouldn't even know the gospel was going to be preached or published, either one. But you're supposed to read all three. Christ is telling you to read all three. And if you do, you see emphasis because he not only repeats within a given account, he repeats from account to account. And the overall weight to God's people is it's supposed to be impossible to misunderstand. The first 4 seals come before the 5th seal, which is the tribulation. Mr. Armstrong would not have needed to emphasize these things. If he were standing here, he'd say the same thing. But as you get closer, the last group doing the work, who are going to panic, want to panic. Oh, it's getting worse, terrible. You can't panic. You stay the course. All right. I want to read another portion of the book that you don't have. You may have a little bit of this, but let me read it. Because I told you I'm going to absolutely prove to you all these things happen at the end. They've not been happening for 2,000 years in the sense of the seals opening. While they have all been happening for 2,000 years and several of them for 6,000 years, I'm going to prove to you now absolutely that is not what Christ said or what he meant. He meant severity ratchets up. And frequency, intensity and severity, frequency, ratchet up. Here's how I know. Since we all know those things have been going on for thousands of years, and the great question out there, and theologians talk about it all the time. I hear people talk about, how do we know that this stuff's always been going on? I must have been asked that question hundreds of times. There's always been war, famine, and disease. How do we know? And I explain it has to be frequency and severity. Now, Christ interprets himself. Here we go. Christ knows there's been war, famine, disease, pestilence, you know, and earthquakes for 6,000 years. Just get that in your mind. He would know that, so he would know that he would have to give you a means of understanding what he meant when he said what he did. I'm just trying to be as basic as I can. Forgive me for repeating myself. But millions and millions and hundreds of millions are not going to understand this. An entire world of Christianity isn't going to understand it. A lot of them believe in a rapture. They don't have any idea who the Antichrist is or the beast or the system that will produce it or the order of anything. False prophets are more common than snow in a blizzard. And it gets worse and worse. So I want us to be crystal clear on this. Now here we go. Grasp what you have learned. This is still in a fourth of men near the end of the chapter. Fix it in the center of your mind. Then recognize that everything is in place for the final wave of death brought by the first four seals with accompanying factors to storm the earth. The seals are open and the horses, as though being whipped by their riders, are running faster every day. Their effects are not like a switch that flips off suddenly, taking a room to darkness, but rather like a gradual turning down of a dimmer switch until a room is pitch black. An analogy I think I used at the feast. So then, prior to even the start of the Great Tribulation, the unlocking of the dreaded fifth seal, an entire quarter of man's population will perish. May God help you to comprehend just this one sentence. I've been literally almost sick for the last week in having to prepare these broadcasts. I've never seen it, even as clearly myself. The force and weight, as I said earlier in the book, just it's ever with you. It doesn't lessen with time. So, no mystery, no symbolism, no cryptic coded language is involved in Revelation 6:8. God is plain, one-fourth of men. The death of so many, coupled with the economic upheaval and chaos this will bring, will drive the world toward a thought-to-be political religious solution infinitely worse than what is the mere opening salvo of all that happens, the horses and the earthquakes. This book is already mentioned several times. Now, this is all new. How most do not take God's word seriously. Of course, while he knew it would happen, this was never what Jesus intended when he uttered the prophecies described in this and the previous five chapters. He didn't want the world to not take seriously. He just knew they wouldn't, so he spoke to his disciples. In fact, so no one could possibly miss the certainty of all these horrific fulfillments to come just before his return, he concluded all three accounts of the Olivet prophecy, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and I could add John very similarly in Revelation. You'll see in a moment what I'm talking about, with a similar statement. Since Jesus repeated himself three times for emphasis, counting Revelation 4, they are all included here for the same reason. Here we go. After listing all that we have been discussing, Jesus said in Matthew, "Verily, or truly, I say unto you, this generation," not that one in the first century, but the 21st century, "this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not pass away." Now Mark, "Verily I say unto you that this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled." After the war, famine, disease pass, all of that. "Heaven and earth shall pass." And by the way, of course, the fifth seal and sixth and the day of the Lord, all of what he was saying. "But my words shall not pass away." And Luke records, "Verily I say unto you, this generation," one generation, no generation I know of that's lived 2,000 years, "shall not pass away till all be fulfilled. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away." Now ask if Jesus took seriously his own words. He literally elevated the fulfillment of all the prophetic horrors described through this book above the certainty of the continued existence of the entire universe, including earth. Think God's serious? And again, he repeated this three times so no one could doubt what would happen. So there would be no room for dismissive thinking or minimizing what would occur. How could anyone find a way to believe the prophecies described by Christ will not come to pass, or I might add, in one generation, 25 years, 30 years? What's the length of a generation, average? On only one other occasion did Christ call the existence of heaven and earth into the equation to demonstrate the certainty of his words. It is instructive. Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets, the Old Testament. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. Impossible to misunderstand, right? I'm still reading. And also impossible to ignore or dismiss, right? Wrong. The vast majority of ministers in the world of professing Christianity, with their millions of parishioners happily agreeing, have rejected the Ten Commandments, the law, as only for the Jews, having convinced themselves they were done away, nailed to the cross, supposedly by the very Jesus Christ who spoke of their certain continuance. I continue to conclude. Never underestimate the power of human beings to delude themselves through human reasoning into rejecting the plain words of God, words that are impossible to misunderstand. If you doubt this, just hand this book to one of your friends and then, assuming they will read it, see if they share your conviction about it. Let's summarize. The greatest proof that the four horsemen of the apocalypse have not been riding for the last 2,000 years, but rather represent conditions that only come to pass at the end of the age, is that their entire fulfillment would be contained within a single generation. The evidence is in. We are now deep into that generation. The room will soon go black. Christ is not inconsistent. What he said to the disciples in the first century, maybe even God inspired them to ask so they'd ask a question that none of them would really understand but think they did, so that we would. All right. Some concluding thoughts. We're going into now, in these final years, something where there is no grand pattern to look to. We talk about the grand pattern. You've heard me mention that. There is no parallel in world history to learn from. When Solomon said there is no new thing under the sun, that's, you now know, generally true. What we're going to go through has never been experienced before, and most of what I'm talking about, remember, is only the part of the horror, the world punishment, and punishment of Israel, a little after that, really, punishment of the world, all nations, that occurs while we still have to do the work. The last three waves are after we do the work. We're in a place of safety if we've been faithful in doing the work and in growing and overcoming. If you say the bubonic plague or Spanish flu in world history or world wars occurred, well, those things didn't all occur at the same time, along with many others, including great earthquakes and tremendous famines, again, at the same time. That isn't the way they came. The Spanish flu was 1,000 years, 900 years, whatever it was, after the bubonic plague. They were bad, but they were single events unaccompanied by all the other things the horsemen bring. It's critical we understand that. Matthew sets the table, then Mark adds more, then Luke, in that order, for a reason. And 65 years later, which is soon enough for Christ, not for the first century apostles for whom it did not apply, sealed the understanding, if you will. Sorry it's a pun, but it should seal your understanding quite literally when he explained the seals. There would always be a final church, final church age, if you will, a final generation of the church that was part of this generation, a final work, a final ministry, and a final leader. So I'm the one giving this sermon, that would have to explain these things. I'm actually going to explain next week, in a portion of the sermon, certain promises of God, absolute immutable promises of God, that the final generation of God's church cannot claim. I'm going to give you about 5 of them. You can't claim. This is a unique generation going through a unique time. No grand pattern, no world parallel, never been a time like it. Now, the flood, that was bad. Yes, okay, the flood was bad. Everybody drowned real fast. One event, everybody. A few people in a boat for 6 months. Sodom and Gomorrah was a type. all wiped out, but there's a couple cities. Never been anything like this. So there has to be an emphasis as we now go into it. 40 years ago, I would read these things, and they were prophecies, relatively speaking, were kind of cold. I don't say they were, I wasn't interested. I was always interested, but it just wasn't happening. It's almost like after Mr. Armstrong's death, I noticed things began to accelerate. Now, I don't know exactly. God could be counting the generation from some point back at World War II, and I don't know how you determine that. A generation typically would be 25 or 30 years. I can't tell you when these things began to pick up. But I can tell you in the 80s, the Vatican began to be more active. Wars in the Middle East and other places began to pick up slowly. And it's like volcanic activity. You get a belch of smoke and then a little worse, then a little lava, and you can have a massive explosion. We're getting very, very close to the massive explosion. Now, just as I take no pleasure in writing this horrible, awful book that I had to write, I understand that somebody had to do it. And my salvation's attached to it, as I've explained in other sermons. Yours isn't. Yours is attached to whether you assist, but mine is attached to the necessity that's laid on me. Somebody had to stand up and explain to whatever and wherever and whoever was the final generation of God's people that this awful time is just about upon us. That said, we'll come to part 2 next week.